The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. 'Tis the season to be jolly. The bells are ringing, the holly wreaths are up, the lights are lit, the shopping rushes on, and thousands of businesses, totally dependent on the year's end buying spree, are now looking forward to another record year. To many, whether or not the Christmas season brings in a significant percentage of their annual profits will determine whether they even stay in business or not. But all of this, the nostalgia of Bing and White Christmas, the smells of eggnog and hot buttered rum, the kissing under the mistletoe and the scenes of happy children wassailing in the snow, all of this is the greatest religious holiday of the year. 'Tis the season to be jolly. Why are so many people trying suicide? And how come so many blue-collar workers and clerks and part-time high school and college students working in these busy supermarkets and stores and department stores and the like are stealing the boss blind? And how come so many hundreds of thousands of people have got headaches from stress and dizzying traffic jams and overworked long hours in the shopping spree of a diminishing paycheck, of taking money out, spending it on gifts for people they don't really know all that well, who can't use it anyway? The whole concept, to some people, is an effrontery. Now, if you, too, have difficulty getting into a holiday mood, you don't really need to feel like you're either some sort of a weirdo or all by yourself. To many religionists, for example, the commercialization of Christmas is an effrontery, and they urge, put Christ back in Christmas. To others, the whole concept of Christmas is an effrontery, and they say that Christ was never in Christmas in the first place. And to the shoppers? Well, when you look at some of the stimuli affecting people's lives and you realize that out of it all, you're probably going to be reading in your newspapers a story of stress, not Scrooge, of frustrations, traffic jams, ruined hopes, loneliness, and artificial joy out of a bottle that really results oftentimes in wrecked homes, automobiles, and ruined lives, you begin to wonder, what's it all about? In psychological terms, the most common affliction is a reactive sort of depression to an event which causes stress. And you begin to wonder, is it really worth it all? I mean, all that money spent, all of that time and energy consumed, all those traffic jams. It's a season to be jolly, but sometimes the holiday hassle makes it a little hard to be so happy. Bills, traffic, maddening crowds are enough to make you wonder, is it really worth it? Do you ever stop to wonder why we do it? Do you ever stop to wonder what are the origins of the Western world celebration of Christmas? Did you know that, believe it or not, it took the Christian church at Rome over 300 years to begin celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ on December 25th, which was originally a pagan holiday? Did you know the celebration of December 25th long antedates Christianity? Do you know what is the origin of mistletoe and why it's good for kissing under? Do you know where holly wreaths came from and who Santa Claus really was and whether he exists or not? You ought to write for two free booklets. One is called The Plain Truth About Christmas, and the other is called Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, Which? And then the current number of the Plain Truth magazine has an article on the first Christmas in Rome. It's absolutely free of charge if you will dial the toll-free number 800-423-4444. This whole thing of Christmas shopping is something for you to wonder about, to look into history and to find out about, to wonder why you see murder at an all-time high in the 24-hour period around and encompassing Christmas Eve, to wonder why suicides are up and theft is up, and house fires and all assorted forms of violence and automobile accidents and drunk driving and all of these various stress conditions in society, and wonder why we do it. Where did it come from? Where did we get it? And why do we seem to be hooked on a cycle that we can't seem to break? So don't worry about it if you're one of those who feels you're not going to have enough money to really enjoy it. You're probably going to be frustrated, disappointed, feel rejected by a lot of your friends. You are going to assume that your neighborhood friends are having a lot of fun, but you know your own life is miserable. Don't really be upset if you feel that way, because large numbers of people experience these and other so-called Christmas reactions. There was a study conducted by the University of Utah's College of Medicine that found a 22-year-old divorced woman who had a spell of crying and hives. And subsequent studies found an increase in suicide attempts during holiday seasons, especially Christmas. And it seemed that all of these various stimuli of the expectations and the hopes of visits, of exciting little confrontations or maybe little tete-a-tetes between people in the neighborhood scene or the neighborhood bar, trips to visit relatives, exchanging of gifts, the love-hate relationship with people, family relations usually, the financial burden of gift-giving, that these tend to fall pretty hard on people. And sometimes they react with combined physical and psychological aberrant behavior that can burst out into open murder over the Christmas turkey dinner. And if you will check police blotters and find out just how often you find some violence occurring at a time when people are supposed to be all that jolly and happy, I think you'll be a little bit amazed. You know, a lot of people go on what are called Christmas shopping strikes. When you go talk to people who work in some of the stores, you look at the faces of shoppers elbowing one another out of the way, nervous, irritated, agitated, uptight, and you wonder about people sitting in long traffic jams in snow-clogged or icy streets oftentimes, and of course we're getting good belts from old man winter across the eastern part of the United States way early. And you begin to realize the way people really react to it, it's almost like a pain, a trial, and an obnoxious task that isn't really required anyway. So you begin to wonder, why do people do it? Well, somehow we're hooked. Everybody else does it, and we feel we must. But in some cases, people have gone on a Christmas shopping strike, refusing to buy any gifts. Sometimes family members fail to reciprocate when a gift is received. And so they have a feeling of maybe superiority. They're going on a strike, but then the person who doesn't receive a gift in return feels all let down, let out, miffed, and cut off, and like they've been deeply wounded. You'd be amazed at the psychological problems and the strain of unhappy families faking happiness during the so-called Christmas season. To an unhappily married couple, the parents and children at odds, or otherwise strife-ridden families, Christmas can be a kind of a cruel reminder of their deviance from the so-called American family ideal. Oh, we like to look at the cards on the mantle and think about that idealistic setting of father and mother and the kids with ruby cheeks standing around the tree with an eggnog bowl clearly visible, singing Christmas carols with a peaceful scene of snow outside and the beautiful fir trees all covered with snow, the little cottage and the bright star shining, and somehow a beatific vision of angelic heavenly hosts all smiling down with joy. It's just such a wonderful scene that they paint on some of these cards that we buy commercially by the hundreds and clog the mails with. But does it really come out that way in practical fact in most people's families? The answer is no. An awful lot of mothers have to carry the emotional weight of keeping up appearances of a happy, united, mutually caring family when it just isn't true at all. An awful lot of otherwise subdued family frictions usually show up at about Christmas time. You'll find out, if you'd care to check homicide records, that the predominant amount of homicides, murders, take place between members of the same family and very, very close family relatives and friends. That it's not just some thug somewhere out with a pistol waving it around killing someone he never saw before, although there's a great deal of that too. But the largest percentage is people who know one another. Then why is it that, add to that the fact that homicide is up dramatically over some of these holiday seasons, and you begin to wonder why we do it? There are even those who are afflicted with what is called Christmas blues who are given advice in Lonely Hearts columns about how to restore their spirits by breaking out of various patterns that might depress them. They're told to get out and get involved, not to sit at home and watch television. As other people are having a big gay time on New Year's Eve, they might end up deciding, why bother? They're having fun, I'm sitting here out of it, and take some strong action. So they're told in these columns to get out and make new friends and get involved in volunteer work, and don't sit through the holiday dinner with your in-laws. Take a vacation 1,000 miles away. Go to Honolulu and bask in the sun. Go to Australia, where it's the middle of the summer. So if you maybe feel that you're going to have some blues during the Christmas season, you ought to do yourself a favor and write in for this booklet in the current number of the magazine and just investigate it. Now, that would be a task That would be real simple. If you bought, probably you didn't need it because your kids never referred to them, but maybe you bought a set of encyclopedias one time. An awful lot of people did. I better be careful, I'll get the encyclopedia people writing me letters. Nothing wrong with owning a set of encyclopedias if you need it, can afford it, and really want to use it. Every family needs one. They really do, if they would use it. But an awful lot of millions of families have books of that nature, wherein you can find reference material to prove what I'm about to tell you without ever going outside of your own home. You can simply look up Christmas. Do you ever think to look up Christmas? I know we take it for granted. It's all a part of a very warm, nostalgic family kind of an environment. The wreaths are up, the holly and the mistletoe, and the trees are decorated, the lights are dimly shining, the gifts are getting bought and wrapped and packaged. We're buying the eggnog mix and buying the rum to go along with the hot buttered rum. We're thinking about the neighborhood party, the office party, the family party, the turkey, the trip, and Aunt Mame who's coming over for a visit, and Grandma, and how she'll be faring this Christmas time. Oh, it's all tradition, nostalgia, and it's good, isn't it? Well, believe it or not, Christmas does not celebrate the birthday of Jesus Christ. You may as well hang a Santa Claus outfit on Nimrod, because it would be far more applicable to exactly what is going on. You could take some ancient Byzantine monk of some kind and hang a Santa Claus beard on him, and you'd have a far more accurate portrayal of who old Saint Nick really was and who he represents than the jolly little character that is supposed to visit everybody by sliding down his chimney, which is impossible, of course, on Christmas time. Now, I know we enjoy some of these unbelievable fantasies. We enjoy the tradition, the nostalgia, and I guess people even enjoy the massive financial ripoff. I don't know. But anyway, it's about time we began to investigate it. About this time, worried mothers are turning off the radio so their four-year-olds can't find out that there isn't any Santa Claus, that ducks don't really talk and wear jackets, and that Bambi did not really marry Faline. It comes as an absolute shock to us a little later on in life. And I guess people like to indulge themselves by saying we dare not deny our children these myths because they would grow up abnormal if we told them the truth. Okay, so be it. But anyway, you ought to look up the truth and find out where all of this came from. Did you know that originally December 25th was called the Saturnalia? That the ancient Romans had this wild, riotous festival during this time, which was basically an appeal to the sun, the god of the sun, to come back and bring those longer days and the warmth that would grow the vegetables, the nuts, and the fruits, and all this again, and start the sap flowing in the trees and the grass growing, and it was sort of an appeal to the gods of the weather to bring summer back again. Well, maybe it even had roots that go back deeper than that when you look at ancient Babylon, Greece, and some of the ancient civilizations of the Far East. You ought to really look into it because you will find that only in A.D. 354, and that's a long time after the time Jesus walked the earth, and this was under the auspices of Liberius, Bishop of Rome, did the city of Tibur, or on the Tiber rather, Rome, start to observe Christmas. Now why, you'd like to ask the question, why did the church, and I would like to go on to say that you need to investigate whether or not the church which was in Rome at that time was the same church that was started by Jesus Christ of Nazareth and the early apostles of James and Peter and John and the apostle Paul, because you can't find any mention whatsoever in the first several years of their writings in the Bible itself about Christmas. There isn't the remotest hint that the apostle Paul or any of those people ever celebrated such a holiday. But now when you find that even the church at Rome, of which history says that after that first lost century, when the veil was drawn back, as it were, where there is a great deal of missing literature, missing information, and then suddenly you see a church emerging in the pages of dusty history along about the beginning of the second century, that church which emerges bears no resemblance to the church which Jesus founded and the early apostles and disciples were busily preaching and causing to grow and causing its message to reach parts of the Mediterranean world and even up into England and into Europe before their lifespans were over. History tells you that from the first to the second century, there were dramatic changes that went along, so that by the time the veil is drawn back and once again you begin to read about the so-called Christian church, it virtually doesn't bear any resemblance to the church Jesus started. Well, okay, even looking at that church, the church which already doesn't bear any resemblance to the church of the New Testament times, did you know that the church in Rome didn't celebrate any pagan holiday called Christmas until pre-54 A.D.? Now you've got to ask the question, why in those first hundreds of years did the church, even the church at Rome, fail to celebrate Christmas? Why did they abstain from commemorating Christ's birth for so long a time? And why, then, did that church sanction and begin celebrating Christ's birthday on a pagan holiday? Because, you see, for centuries prior to the advent of Christianity, Rome was a pagan city, indulging in the worship of pagan deities of both sexes. The emperor himself was called a god. They worshipped every conceivable concept of gods clattering across the heavens in their chariots, making love, making war, coming down and living with human beings. They thought that gods were a dirty bunch of lot, because I guess they could see that's the way they were and figure their gods ought to be the same way. So as was common practice in that very much polytheistic age of belief in many so-called divinities, every divinity had a birthday. And that birthday was commemorated annually by the people. Now, we have our George Washington's birthday and all that, but they had their various pagan divinities' days. They had Apollo and Zeus and all these various gods. So during those days, it was not customary for the masses to observe their own birthdays, but rather the day of birth of their own chosen divinity. And they had so many of these divinities that these ancient pagans could choose which one they liked the best. They could look at the statues there and figure out the muscular development. They could study the life's woes, tragedies, wars, conquests, etc., and love trysts of their favorite divinity. And they could decide, oh, I like her or him or this other divinity, so that's my favorite god. So from that time on, they observed the birthday, not when they were born, but the birthday of their favorite god. Now, I don't know if that's done anywhere today or not, similarly to that, but anyway, it sure was done in ancient pagan Rome. Now, at that time, two celestial beings had really begun to stand out as the principal objects of worship and veneration. That was Jupiter. Originally, his name came from Jupiter, but that's another story. Jupiter, whose birthday fell in September, and Saturn, who was honored in December. Saturn is supposed to be the name of one of the great planets with the rings around it. It's also the ancient divinity that the Romans believed in, which has found its way in the calendar in the modern United States of America and the Western world. It is called Saturn's Day, or the Day of Saturn, when it should be called just the Sabbath, or the seventh day of the week. But by the time of Christ, many of the religious practices surrounding the worship of these so-called gods, who didn't really exist, mind you, Jupiter, Saturn, and so many lesser divine luminaries, appealed to the masses less and less. So even though it was sanctioned by the state, the Roman populace had little desire to perpetuate the archaic religion of their forefathers. A new era required up-to-date religious concepts. The search for a new and more exciting religion was on, and here's what began to happen. During those first 3 centuries of that ancient Roman Empire, a lot of Eastern philosophers and mystics had begun to preach the divine efficacy and nature of the sun. And religion of the sun began to predominate and take place over Jupiter and Saturn and Mars and some of these others. And so the sun god became an acquaintance of many of these people in Rome. And immigrants from the east brought knowledge of the worship of the sun, which was so widespread in Syria, Persia, and other nations. And so they became acquainted with sun worship. And they found out there were some real exciting ceremonies you can have if you go to worshiping the sun. And they had to do with times, with seasons, and with the weather. And it's a lot more fun than just worshiping Saturn because, you know, the sun's a lot easier to see than Saturn. Saturn doesn't warm your back or grow your crops. The sun does. And so, first century Roman historian Tacitus describes that at the Battle of Bedrecum in A.D. 69, the soldiers of Emperor Vespasian saluted the rising sun with loud shouts. And he talks about how loud shouts arose from the entire army as they hailed the rising sun. Well, you can find in history in this article you'll read in the Plain Truth magazine, if you want to call for it, many other examples and quotations showing you the page number of the books of how these early emperors and the armies and people of Rome began to take an increasing interest in sun worship. Now, by the time of about 218, the new emperor was in, began to realize the time had come to oust old Jupiter from his celestial throne and replace him with a statue of the Syrian sun god. Now, he'd been to Syria, this emperor. I believe it's Elagabalus. He's a funny-looking name, but anyway, have you ever heard of Elagabalus? He was one of the emperors of ancient Rome clear back in 218. Awful name. But he took a trip to Syria, and he came back very visibly impressed with their idea of a sun god. And so he set up this sun god, who was known by the name of Baal. As a matter of fact, Egalabalus, or whatever it is, his name, even put the B-A-L in the middle of his name as a part of Baal. So he was even named after Baal. It was the name of a well-known deity in ancient times that is found all throughout the Old Testament, as a matter of fact. Some of the ancient nations in the land of Palestine that were ousted by the Israelis of that time, the Israelites, who were being given the so-called promised land of the Bible, they were ousting these people who were worshippers of Baal. You may remember the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Now, Baal was the sun god. And the story that came along about Baal was that he was born on December 25th. It's all very interesting reading when you look into history books about the origin of Christmas. So the solar religion became established, the worshiping of the sun. And they used to actually hail the sun in ancient Rome. It was by the time of Constantine, clear down into the 300s A.D., when he so-called, as a pagan Roman emperor, of course, finally was converted to the worship of the Christian church. But before that time, he was a sun worshiper. And by the time of his so-called conversion, the acceptance of his new religion, well, he was facing an awkward problem, the same way that anciently, when the nation of Israel was about to divide, when the servant of Solomon, Jeroboam, took over the northern tribes, and the son of Solomon, Rehoboam, kept just Judah and Benjamin and portions around the southern part of Israel, well, when that secession, that civil war virtually, that split came along, and two separate kingdoms of Israel in the north and Judah in the south began to be set up, there was the problem about keeping these people away from the traditional center of worship, which was Jerusalem. So the idea is just set up an Asherah or some groves or a statue in the northern part of the country, and especially set up an alternative date for the festival, the feasts, the holy days that they observed in that time of the Feast of Tabernacles, the Passover, and the like. So that's exactly what they did. Now, Constantine could easily see that he had a problem. Here he had been a pagan sun worshiper, and now he embraced Christianity. But he had been going along with his solar worship, and he'd been worshiping Baal and the sun god on December 25th. Now, how would the church begin to deal with this very awkward situation where the Roman emperor recently sanctioned Christianity as the state religion and ruling over a completely pagan empire? Well, he probably had the same idea some of those early priests did when they came into Mexico. I saw years and years ago that there was a way by which they figured a cute little method of combining the two. You see, anciently in the cities of the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayans, and other civilizations in Central and South America and in Northern South America, in Peru and the like, but principally in the nation of Mexico, when some of these early people came in there to try to Christianize these savages, they found that these ancient pagans were worshiping a kind of a snake god that was called Quetzalcoatl. And the word Quetzal meant snake, and the word Quetzal meant a winged or a feathered creature. As a matter of fact, one of the Central American countries has the denomination of the Quetzal is its money, and they're called so many Quetzales, and I think it is Honduras, but don't quote me on that. It's been a while since I looked. At any rate, they found a method by which they could take this obvious worship of a winged flying serpent, which you'll find described, by the way, in the 12th chapter of Revelation, but that's an aside, and they built a baptismal font out of this coiled serpent, so that as these savages came by, they could see this huge snake and his ugly, leering snake's head with his fangs, and there was good old Quetzalcoatl, their pagan god, But at the same time, this guy dressed up in his funny garb was dipping his hands in his so-called holy water that he blessed and sprinkling it on their foreheads and saying, now you are a Christian, now you are a Christian, and kind of changing them from pagan to Christian. That was real cute the way they did that. Now, ancient Constantine did it the same way. What he did was to not only convert himself to Christianity, but to convert the whole empire to Christianity. Now, that's a pretty good task, you know, for even a pagan king. But he managed to do it by just simply embracing the same old days of Baal worship and the religion of the sun, so popular among all the adherents of the pagan Roman Empire, and by simply establishing the major Christian holy days on the same dates, using the same various paraphernalia of trees, berries, parasites, Yule logs, the exchanging of gifts, bonfires, big orgiastic banquets, and all the accoutrements and paraphernalia of the pagan celebration. So it was a remarkable transformation. At first, the church tried to influence Constantine to abolish the solar religion, sun worship, with that December 25th festival. But Constantine was a born sun worshiper, and he refused to do that because he said the festival was just too popular among all of these as yet unconverted subjects in the Roman Empire to eradicate it outright. So after further consultations and the church pressuring Constantine to pass a law by which all slaves in Rome would be given their freedom if they would accept Christianity, it finally resulted in the masses lining up for baptism into the Christian religion. And it was hoped that such a measure would prevent these baptized heathens from observing pagan festivals, particularly the December 25th festival dedicated to the solar divinity, the sun god, or Baal. But the scheme backfired, unfortunately, because the heathen element within that church continued to adhere to its own so-called Sol Invictus religion. The masses still joined the heathen element each December 25th in celebrating the festival of the so-called unconquerable sun. It was just too popular to get rid of, and so gradually, once Rome had accepted the December date for the birth of Christ, which I think even they must have known was in error, and which historians and authorities prove is in error even today, it became firmly entrenched in the ancient, pagan, now Christianized, so-called, Roman Empire, and it's come down to us on December 25th ever since. The early Christian church had always been against celebrating the birthday of Jesus Christ because the Bible said that they were to celebrate his death day. The early apostles were told to celebrate the day of his death, the Passover, which Jesus himself gave the symbols for, and that was to be a major event. But here we are in the Western world of so-called professing Christianity going once again into the mad buying shopping spree of Christmas, the last-minute rush of hectic, bothersome traffic jams, and not even wondering why we're doing it. If you want to find what is the origin of the custom of merrymaking and gift-giving, where did mistletoe come from? What about the Yule log and wassailing and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? And what is the origin of Santa Claus and the giving of gifts? Then you write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. That gives you a great deal more than I've had time to do in this brief broadcast about Christmas, and also these articles about strategies for coping with inflation, but it was an accident, about the Soviet Jews in America, other articles in the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. Ask for the booklet, too, The Plain Truth About Christmas. Dial the toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. It's absolutely free of charge. Your operator is waiting to take your call right now, or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.